Welcome. I'm Angie Coiro, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. This is Your Call. U.S. corporate consolidation of wealth and power has reached a level not seen since the youngest days of the 20th century, when industrial monopolies dominated the economy. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance says we've lost 65,000 small independent retailers in the last decade. Walmart captures more than half of grocery sales in dozens of metropolitan areas. Four giant meatpacking corporations control 85% of beef processing. Two telecom corporations dominate internet access. Even beer has its own private club. Three corporations make a staggering three-quarters of American beers. Then there's the true behemoth, Amazon. The company sells more books and toys than any other retailer. It captures nearly one of every $2 that Americans spend online. That's according to the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Wikipedia lists a whopping 113 Amazon acquisitions since 1998. Maybe you don't realize they own or incorporated all of these. The Internet Movie Database, or IMDb. Abe Books, the online used bookstore. Egghead Software, Brilliance Audio, Audible, Zappos Online Shoe Store, Woot, Goodreads, Twitch, Whole Foods, Ring, and MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And that is just a taste of those 113 acquisitions. Now it's One Medical and iRobot, makers of Roomba vacuums. Amazon has been pushing into the healthcare space for years. It acquired PillPack, an online pharmacy, in 2018 and launched its own pharmacy in 2020, offering Prime members special discounts on drugs not covered by their insurance. Amazon even briefly made its own COVID tests. Today we'll take a look at two recent and staggering corporate monopolies and mergers. The first, Amazon's decision to purchase One Medical for $4 billion. Eating that up exposes the health data of millions to Amazon, a company with a shaky record around privacy regulations. And we'll dive into an antitrust trial happening right now. The government is challenging the merger of the country's two largest book publishers, Simon & Schuster and Penguin Random House. Those two companies say they're merging to better compete with Amazon. Opponents are warning the marriage could make the industry less diverse and make it harder for authors of color to get published. Authors also worry the deal could drive down their earnings. The U.S. did robustly curtail monopolies after the Sherman Act passed in 1890. What has happened to that resolve? We've got two guests with us today. Stacy Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. That research and advocacy organization challenges concentrated corporate power in favor of thriving, equitable communities. ILSR is a pioneering leader in the growing anti-monopoly movement, working with grassroots groups to develop alternatives. Sarah Miller is founder and executive director of the American Economic Liberties Project. Launched in 2020, it's a hub for anti-monopoly expertise and advocacy. Its programs focus on protecting states and communities, national security, entrepreneurs, and small businesses from corporate power. Sarah is a regular advisor to policymakers. She served on President Biden's transition team and is a former deputy director of the Open Markets Institute. Stacy and Sarah, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Angie.
So nice to be here. Thanks.
I'm so glad to have you. Let's get some definitions out there first. Sarah, if I can start with you, how does the federal government define a monopoly?
That's a great question. So there's laws on the books, and they've been on the books since the late 19th century, that charge not just the federal government, but state governments as well, with controlling monopoly power and controlling mergers that lead to monopolies. So, you know, you can look at a market and you can kind of identify where market power is shifting, where market power resides. And that's how, that's the charge that both federal and state regulators have under their purview. So, you know, we can look at behavior, direct evidence. We can look at market share. There's a number of ways of making these determinations. And really, at the root of it, some of the cause of the kind of collapse in antitrust enforcement is the ability to manipulate those definitions in ways that preference monopolies and those who are kind of enriched by them, right? Mm-hmm. The whole kind of cadre of lawyers and bankers and former policymakers. So that's a great question. And it really is in many ways at the center of the debate around what went wrong and how to make it right.
You know, I vaguely remember from my youngest days in school learning about monopolies, and the impression I came away with and some of the definitions I found online seemed to put an emphasis on a corporation controlling one property. Investopedia says it has little to no competitors, and its consumers have no real substitutes for the good or service provided by the business. Note the good singular or service singular. And I'm wondering, Stacey, if some of the resistance coming from the corporations, especially with Amazon, they're not a singular service. They're not dominating oil. They're not dominating steel. They sell everything.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, monopoly has that component to it of mono. And so a lot of people, you know, sort of default to this idea of one company. And certainly big corporations want to define monopoly that way for their own ends, one company controlling an entire product. But in fact, that's not the legal definition. It never has been. And it's really not the right way to think about what monopoly power is and why we need to control it. It's really a good definition, I think, of monopoly is when one company has the ability to dictate terms and to bully other companies and entities in the market into doing what they want. So it's the ability to demand a special favor from a supplier. It's the ability to single-handedly raise prices or to single-handedly control whether or not a particular producer has access to the market. It's that kind of power where you're not just one among many market participants, where you actually have the power to dictate and bully. And that's how the federal government defines monopoly. And for, you know, in many sectors, that kind of power exists at market shares that are far, far lower than 100%. In many cases, it can be as little as 20 or 25% or maybe even less, where that is enough of a market share that you are able to dominate and dictate terms and shape outcomes in a market. And that's what a monopoly really is.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting today, listening to the radio, I heard knowing, of course, that we're going to talk about this, I heard a commercial for Uline, which used to have the corporate dominance in packaging materials. Companies would go to Uline for their boxes and their packing materials. And to hear that advertising for what I believe is the first time, it notes that even companies that seemed to have cornered the market suddenly have to go out, spend the money on making the case that, hey, we're out here too. And I think that, you know, Sarah, if you look at that, one of the issues is not all the companies threatened by the behemoths have money for advertising, or it cuts into a very thin profit margin already.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's exactly right. I think there are so many ways that kind of a corporation with dominant market power can disadvantage their competitors by leveraging that power, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think they're just very directly, you can hike prices on the smaller businesses that you have to do business with you. You know, we saw during the pandemic, Facebook raised the prices of its advertising by almost a third, right? That really affected a lot of small businesses that are reliant on Facebook, have to use Facebook to reach their customers. Mm-hmm. We see kind of large businesses use coercive contract terms with their suppliers. So one fun example that we came across is Gore-Tex, which forced users of its fabric not to work with any rivals if they wanted to work with Gore-Tex, which was the dominant firm. They're able to demand lower prices from wholesalers than the small business across the street. So Stacey knows this well, but Walmart can buy a unit of orange juice for much less than a smaller grocery store can buy from the same wholesaler. That used to be illegal, and it still is illegal. It's not been enforced for many years. Mm-hmm. Large monopolies, dominant firms can lossly. They can underprice the market to drive competitors out of business in ways that smaller businesses certainly can't do. That also is something that should be enforced against. And then, you know, they can erect essentially toll booths. So during the pandemic, we saw delivery apps which were the intermediary between restaurants and consumers, charge restaurants upwards of 30% of every purchase that they made, to the point where, you know, restaurants already operating on very thin margins could barely get by because of that middleman status. So I could keep going. And we have an initiative called Access to Markets and Economic Liberties, which really looks at what we call the other red tape, the behavior that sort of private regulators, dominant firms, impose on markets that affect entrepreneurs and small businesses. And there's just a diversity of ways, many of which we think enforcers should and are starting to step in and address, that large dominant firms are able to disadvantage and bully, as Stacey said, smaller ones.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about consumer awareness of this. If you own a small business, you know all about this. You're the one who has to set the prices. You're the one who are being undercut by the larger corporations. But in terms of how the consumer sees this, if I want a pair of gloves, I can go to Amazon, but I can also go to Macy's. I go to Target, Sears, Kohl's. So do I understand fully as a consumer that there's an issue here? And I'll leave that to either of you.
Yeah, I mean, I think Americans are experiencing this in all kinds of ways. I mean, as consumers, we're certainly feeling it in the sense that the range of products available to us is shrinking. There are fewer and fewer new products being created. There's less product diversity because of consolidation in the retail channel. You know, when you have, you know, just a handful of companies that are the primary sellers of goods, we know from research that you see a decline in the ability of companies to develop and find an audience for new products. So we see this in the book sector. I mean, this is a really good example. You mentioned the effort underway by the federal government to stop this merger among publishers. And that's an area where there is quite documented evidence that as publishing consolidates, and particularly as the retailing of books consolidates in the hands of Amazon, that people are being steered, readers are being steered to a relatively small number of top-selling books more and more. And the range of authors and publishers, small publishers that are able to bring books to market has been shrinking. We are actually seeing a shrinking of diversity. But more important, I think, even than that, is all of the ways that we're experiencing this as people who need to earn a living. You know, I mean, we are seeing dramatic, stagnation in wages over the last few decades. And we know that that's because of consolidation, that there are fewer and fewer opportunities, fewer and fewer companies that are competing for workers, and that market power can be used not only to raise prices, but also to push down wages. And so we've seen that happen where we know households and that the rising inequality is directly connected to this consolidation of market power. And then I think we have to look at like what's happening to our communities and what's happening to our democracy. I mean, ultimately, you know, monopoly is about it's really a key part of how you structure a democracy. If you don't control the private exercise of power, then in effect, you end up, as we have, with these companies that not only run large sectors of our economy, but really control the fate of our communities and have incredible power over our government. And so this is very much at the root of a lot of the problems that we're seeing in our democracy and with the health of our local communities.
That's the voice of Stacey Mitchell. She's co-executive director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. You can find that group at ilsr.org. Sarah Miller is here, too, founder and executive director of the American Economic Liberties Project at economicliberties.us. Let me let you know that you are more than welcome to contribute this hour. Our phone line is open at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I'm Angie Coiro in for Rose today on Your Call. I want to stay with one more thing about what happens to consumers that they may or may not be aware of, and that is that merchants like Walmart and Amazon will often press the providers of goods to lower their prices, to lower that price point. So when you see a coffee pot at a regular retailer, an independent retailer, and you see the same coffee pot online at Walmart, it may in fact be lacking some of the fancy. It may not have the timer on it. It may not have the drip stop on it. And I wonder how many people are really aware of that. Sarah, is consumer awareness an issue in that arena?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I just want to step back for a minute and make one other point, because mm-hmm. I think we have seen a real acceleration in the consumer impact of consolidated corporate power over the past 8 months as inflation has risen really dramatically. So one thing that happens when you have consolidated markets, when there are a handful of kind of dominant corporations that sit on top of a market, is they're able to raise prices in kind of opportunistic ways without actually kind of having to compete with each other, right? It's mm-hmm. It's called kind of an equilibrium collusion or kind of a tacit collusion. And that's something that I think we saw kind of all across the economy, as, you know, a handful of C-suite executives could kind of look across and watch earnings calls and see what their competitors were doing and use inflation as, you know, a kind of a reason for raising prices and increasing margin substantially over their own increased costs. So I think just in the last year, we've really seen kind of everyday consumers look at these dynamics and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, there is a connection here between extreme levels of market power and the fact that I'm having to pay, you know, 40% more for chicken at the meat counter, mm-hmm. right? And so it's been a really important moment, I think, for consumer awareness. Anyone that's, you know, bought a ticket through Ticketmaster and ended up paying by the time you hit the submit button, you know, multiple times the original ticket price. Anyone who has found kind of a random charge on their internet bill, you know, certainly when it comes to things like prescription drugs, right? These are all consumer facing impacts that are because of monopoly power. And I think as you see the Biden administration, as you see more political leaders, as you see more business leaders kind of speaking out and talking about it in those terms, mm-hmm. the public will become kind of more and more aware of it. So I don't know if that kind of answers your precise question, but it's true that, you know, through the guise of lower prices and pushing off costs into other arenas where it's less visible to consumers, there's been an explosion in market power. But I do think we're seeing a real shift in levels of public education, public awareness, and quite frankly, public outrage.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one arena that we haven't talked about yet, and that people are becoming very aware of this very fast with airline chaos. And you see big airlines eat little airlines all the time. And now we have a situation, particularly in Europe, but to some extent in America, where between strikes and people being sick, local staff shortages, the airports are putting caps on how many people are allowed to go through their terminals, how many flights are allowed to come through. Heathrow just said no more flights the rest of the year. If you're not booked with your flight to Cayman already, you can't have any more through Heathrow. And I don't know that people look at that. They see their individual problem. Oh, my trip to Scotland just got canceled. But they don't realize that, again, we're looking at corporations at the root of this. Stacey?
That's absolutely right. I mean, the consolidation in airlines and the ability of these dominant airlines to just exact an incredible toll on travelers is just been something I think people have really felt, especially in the last few months. One aspect of that I think is, you know, really worth reflecting on is, you know, it's been particularly bad for smaller cities. You know, there is a regional aspect to monopoly power. One of the reasons that we have seen wealth and power concentrate in a handful of metro areas. Meanwhile, we have large swaths of the country, you know, both second tier cities and rural areas and small towns that are being left behind. And that's, you know, because of this consolidation where you've got, whether it's airlines that are no longer serving or have very limited service in small cities. I live in a small city and there are lots of places that I can't go, or I have literally one choice in terms of a flight. We've also seen it as manufacturers have consolidated. Often when there's a merger, it comes with the closure of a factory or an office, and that community has lost a major employer. We've seen it as hospitals have consolidated, where there are, you know, large segments of the country that no longer have a local hospital, or they have only one option, and prices are going through the roof and service is going down, and even to the point of it being threatening to your health, and so on. And so, you know, all of these ways in which we're experiencing monopoly power is, you know, it's really is sorting the country very much into like a small number of people who are doing well, and lots of people who, and regions and communities that are being left behind, and where people are really struggling and have a kind of sense of despair because there's no longer that sense of community self-determination, of jobs, of you know, activity at the local level.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, would you like to add to that?
Sure. You know, I think basically, just to say something that might be a little provocative, what the airlines have been doing this summer, because they don't fear losing passengers. You know, you hear people say, I'm never flying United again. Well, if you want to get to Chicago, you're probably going to fly United,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yes.
Like, there's not really a lot of consumer empowerment in the airline industry. And so what the airlines have been doing essentially is selling tickets for flights they know they won't actually operate. Mm-hmm. Which in my mind is a form of fraud. They're taking money for a flight that they know they won't operate, and then they make it quite difficult, as anybody who has ever tried to get a refund or figure out how to, you know, swap a voucher for actually, you know, money, their ticket money back, or who ends up even being stuck in an airport, right? You have very little power when dealing with a massive airline conglomerate to get a fair shake in a situation like that. So, you know, I think what we need to see, and what we really hope to see more of, is large corporations like airlines held accountable when they abuse consumers as egregiously as they've done this summer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Selling tickets for flights they know they won't operate, and then making it very difficult for you to get your money back, in addition to kind of ruining your travel plans, right? So that's a Department of Transportation authority that they alone hold, and is something that we've been working on really aggressively for the last few months. You know, we need our leaders to stand up and show, hey, we're not going to let, you know, giant conglomerates like the airlines just blatantly rip you off, in addition to kind of ruining your vacation.
It is weird. You're right. It's a very strange thing, for example, to oversell a flight. You don't see a theater selling extra tickets and then telling people at the front, you can't come in, but we'll give you $50 to go elsewhere. I mean, it's like it's its own special area. But Sarah, if I can stay with you, we hear about the flyers' rights. We hear about consumers' rights. Why can't we get anything solid? Theoretically, there is a flyer's bill of rights, a passenger's bill of rights. We don't seem to be getting anywhere.
No, you know, Pete Buttigieg is currently the Secretary of Transportation, and during deregulation, the only government entity that has authority to actually enforce consumer protection law and competition is the Department of Transportation. So, you know, that's a question of political will. Can we generate political will to really reform, deconcentrate, regulate, you know, the airlines so that consumers actually kind of have power in the marketplace? And it's emblematic of the problem that we see across a variety of industries, where power really needs to be rebalanced between, you know, corporations and consumers and smaller businesses, so that those competitive dynamics can play out and serve as a check on the power of larger firms. You know, but I think at the end of the day, you know, people need to kind of understand that it's not just corporations who we need to ask to be nicer. We need our regulators to step in and really be aggressive. And I think the airline industry and the abuse we've seen over the summer is a real test case to whether, you know, someone like Pete Buttigieg is going to be able to step up and address it. And mm-hmm. So far, we've not seen that.
We're going to come back in just a moment on Your Call with my guests, Stacey Mitchell and Sarah Miller. We'll also take your phone calls at 866-798-8255 while we discuss monopolies here on Your Call. I'm Angie Coro. Be right back. Welcome back to Your Call. Rose is out today. I'm Angie Coiro sitting in. Stacey Mitchell is here with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and Sarah Miller with the American Economic Liberties Project. I know both of you will have something to say about the banking system. There are four banks controlling more than 41% of U.S. banking assets. You'd think that after the banking disasters of the last decade or so, particularly the mortgage crisis, there would be more of an appetite to break this up, and we're not seeing that. Sarah, let me take that from you first, and then Stacey, I want to talk to you about what's on your website about banking. Sarah?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I was a Treasury official during the financial crisis. That's kind of how I got my start in politics, and it formed a lot of the way that I look at the world. And, you know, I think at that point, there was not a lot of awareness, not a lot of interest in looking at the economy through the lens of power. And the overarching ideology was that bigger is more efficient, bigger is better. And then, of course, you know, there are a lot of people who got enriched during the process of consolidation, whether it's banking or otherwise. So you can't kind of neglect that kind of political layer of consolidation. But I think, you know, when we look at how consolidation impacts the broader economy, we see significant impacts, not just from concentration of risk perspective, but from the types of products and services that are available, from the communities that are served by the provision of small business credit or the lack thereof, and of things like jobs and kind of regional economies that are anchored in local and regional banks. And so I think you can't really separate the kind of crisis in concentrated power kind of in the broader corporate sphere from the banking sector, which not only in and of itself is highly concentrated mm-hmm. with a lot of problematic and unjust downstream effects, but also fuels and kind of has a symbiotic relationship with corporate American concentration in that way. So it's hugely kind of complex. I think, you know, the Fed, as folks might know, has a lot of authority over bank mergers and have approved merger after merger after merger after merger for decades, right? I think only fairly recently, some of the Fed Board of Governors started voting against bank mergers. So I think there is a lot of work to do in that space to really convince the authorities there that there is a real problem that needs to be rethought. That work has started to happen a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's a review of the Bank Merger Act that is currently in play that has been led by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Director Rohit Chopra. So there is some movement there, but really the Federal Reserve, I think, has absolutely kind of failed in every respect to build a resilient and a kind of people-centered banking sector that can facilitate economic dynamism and fairness in local communities.
Mm-hmm. Stacey, on your website, ilsr.org, there's testimony that you gave last year in front of the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. You were talking about the effect of the banking on the state of the rural economy. Why particularly the rural economy?
Yeah, you know, we have often talked about the problem of big banks as, you know, too big to fail. But I actually think the better and more accurate way to talk about the problem of big banks is that they're too big to succeed. Mm-hmm. You know, we have seen this incredible consolidation. We have, as you noted, a handful of banks that control most of the assets in this sector. We have seen a dramatic decline in the number of local community banks and credit unions. I mean, it's just plummeted in the last 10 years. And that decline has been particularly pronounced in rural areas, also Black and Brown neighborhoods and cities. And, you know, the problem with big banks is that they devote a lot of their assets to speculative money-making schemes that have very little to do with actually investing in productive economic development. And in fact, a lot of those money-making schemes do exactly the opposite. They destroy productive resources in order to reward a small number of elite investors. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, we have lost the banks, the local banks, that do the majority of actual lending to small businesses, to farms, to local development, for people to get mortgages and student loans and all of those things. At the local level, where it really matters in your economy, it is those local banks that do the vast majority of that kind of lending. Mm-hmm. And so more and more, as assets have shifted into the hands of the big banks, we're actually choking off that supply of capital, and it's particularly pronounced in rural areas, and you know, increasingly ending up with a banking system that can't even do the thing that you need the banking system to do, which is to fund the real economy. And I would just if I can jump
add
one additional point on that. You know, Sarah noted that there is this really important effort that's beginning, this conversation that's beginning to happen around should we be blocking mergers in the banking sector, and that's I think a really key thing to be paying attention to. But I would also just note that when we look at these four institutions, you know, Bank of America, Citigroup, and so on, that dominate the sector, they are already far too large and too destructively large that I think part of what we need to get to as an answer in the banking sector, but also in other sectors, is how do we spin off these companies? How do we break them up into multiple companies so we can get back to a more functional banking sector?
In fact, I want to follow up on that in just a moment, but Pam has been waiting in San Francisco on the phone lines. So let's go right to her. Pam, you wanted to talk about consumer awareness of monopolies.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
You wanted to talk about consumer awareness of monopolies?
Yes, I did. I wanted to say that you've asked the guests twice, and they've gone on to something else each time you ask them. But I wanted to say that the consumer is not particularly aware of what's happening with monopolies. My father, for example, would always shop at Walmart. And when he went to Walmart for looking for a particular razor, which he could always get at the local pharmacy, he could not find it. And I said, yes, that's the monopoly for you. But he didn't understand that. I use Biblio.com, which is the last company that is not owned by Amazon, which sells used books. I used to use ABE, Abe Books. It's
right.
No longer independent. It's now under Amazon.
Yep.
And so I use Biblio.com. They consolidate small bookstores and nonprofits. And when I talk to people about Amazon, the thing that I say, which is not the best thing to understand it, but I say Bezos has enough money. We don't need to give him any more money, which is true.
I like that very much. Let me get an answer from both of our guests. Sarah, can I start with you?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I think we're just so early in this conversation. I think maybe 2017 or 2018, I was chatting with a colleague here in DC who I'd worked with a number of years ago when I kind of first really was engaging in a lot of this policy work. And he said, huh, that's a little weird. I haven't really heard anyone talk about monopolies since the Microsoft case, you know? So it is such a new area of discourse here in DC. It's such a new area of discourse here in the country. And we just now really have political leaders, including the president, who's starting to talk about it. And I think that kind of dialogue between business people, local communities, local leaders, and, you know, kind of folks in the national media ecosystem is going to be really key. I think it's hard to kind of talk about business practices. It's not, you don't turn on CNN necessarily and hear these types of reports. And I wish that wasn't the case. But one thing that I am really, really encouraged by are the number of leaders in Illinois, in Florida, in Pennsylvania, who are kind of seeing the impact that large multinational extractive corporations have had in their communities and are standing up and organizing around that, whether it's Disney in Florida or an Amazon warehouse in Illinois or a hospital monopoly in Pennsylvania. We are kind of really seeing, I think, a movement develop around this and a language develop around this. But it sounds like Pam is well ahead of the curve. And it's certainly, I think, a work and a movement in progress that touches just such a diverse number of people in different ways as a consumer, as a small business, as an entrepreneur, you know, as a local leader. So I think we're at the beginning of what in my mind is a fairly fast moving political journey. And we hope that that momentum continues.
Stacy, let me add to that, because Pam's experience with her dad is a virtual mirror of my experience with my mom years back. And I think that when you have someone like my mom and her dad who see low prices, it is absolutely counterintuitive to say low prices are adding to inflation. And I think that's why a lot of people aren't connecting A to B.
Yeah, I think that's true. And certainly predatory pricing has been something that Walmart in particular used quite effectively to corner the market in retail and in groceries. What we have also seen in some cases is that when Walmart has gone into a community with low prices, eliminated the competitors, that its prices have begun to rise. And we have also seen a situation where, you know, overall we're seeing grocery prices have gone up quite a bit. Meanwhile, the dollar paid to the farmer has shrunk. And it's the folks in the middle, the handful of dominant grocery chains and processors that are keeping more and more of that dollar. So that's the dynamic. I think you're absolutely right that it is not always easy for consumers to spot how that is happening. And part of what I think is really urgent about, you know, the growing focus with journalists and with policymakers on this issue is to begin to connect those dots between, you know, inflation, between the experiences you're having with the airlines, between the fact that you have terrible internet service and have only one choice, the fact that your community is really struggling in terms of loss of businesses and, you know, a sense of the major decisions that control your community are being made from afar. And these are all monopoly problems, but people haven't necessarily connected those dots. One last thing I'll add on that front, because I think it's important, you know, as we kind of, you know, really start to accelerate this conversation and bring the root, you know, the root problem of monopoly that's behind all of these things more to the fore of people's minds, is monopoly used to be a very active part of the public discourse in the U.S. I mean, it was a subject of, you know, newspaper reporting. Like, monopoly was something that ordinary people talked about as a political issue in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. It's one of the reasons that the economy was quite strong in those periods. We had a lot of discussion politically about monopoly, and we had strong anti-monopoly policies. And what big business did in the 70s and 80s with allies in Congress and in the Oval Office is really push that conversation out, you know, sort of close the doors of antitrust, re-engineer how antitrust works, and allow big business really to amass power and to pretend like the issue of power wasn't really an issue that should be discussed. Mm-hmm. And so part of this process, I think, is really recovering that.
Sarah, North Dakota is the only state that has a state-run bank. And it seems that, and I know that you're in the business of energizing communities to work on these things. It seems like that's something that is such a no-brainer to replace the banking concerns. I wonder if that's part of the discussions that you have.
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many kind of creative policy ideas, particularly at the state level, that I think are now kind of receiving new life and new interest. And that's part of the work that both Stacey and I do at our organizations, is trying to kind of support policymakers on that journey. Mm-hmm. You know, there are state AGs that can bring cases to break up firms. We had, you know, a large consortium of both Republican and Democratic AGs sue to break up Google, for example, now aligned with federal antitrust investigators. But there are kind of countless types of policies that can both serve to help deconcentrate corporate power, to rein in sectors of the economy, and to create markets, you know, using public institutions or restraining private markets in certain ways so that they serve a local population. And a lot of times I think this work is just so resonant when you bring it into a local community, because you can see the impact much more clearly. And, you know, you have research now really aligning with the destruction of jobs, the destruction of the local tax base, the destruction of business dynamism, the lowering of wages, that really connects these kind of deep structural economic problems with kind of far away concentrated corporate and financial power. So the fact that you have all of these state laboratories where right now, you know, there are leaders who kind of are really innovative, really fighting for this is hugely encouraging. And I think we're going to see that network of local leaders really grow and learn from each other in the coming years, hopefully to great impact.
Let's go back to the phones at 866-798-8255 and talk to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thank you. And first, I want to you mentioned Uline, the shipping company that finally had to advertise because Amazon is so big. Now, Uline is not just about shipping. Uline sells essential safety and medical items such as first aid kits, N95 masks, safety goggles, respirator, and surgical masks. So this is huge. We don't want consolidation to when I couldn't get N95 masks locally when supply chains were disrupted, Uline was the only place that I could get some of these health and safety-ish items. And the other thing is the bookstores and the two main publishers merging, we need to support local bookstores. Bibliograph.org is one thing, but bookstores are part of the neighborhood. If you have a bookstore, make it a legacy business. We need to protect small business because this is who we are as a culture. So thank you so much for doing this program.
Oh, thank you for that, Mary. And I do want to clarify, the interpretation of Uline advertising because of Amazon is my speculation. I just want to say that I didn't get that from a professional authority of any sort. With Mary's call, and I want to look at what she's saying about Uline, maybe not being as big as Amazon, but in itself actually capturing some of the market to itself. In this particular case, she was talking about the N95s. It makes me wonder, at what point do you start to call a business a monopoly? Sarah?
Yeah, you know, I think you have to look, and I'll go back to what Stacey said, you have to look at its ability to operate in the market in a certain way that basically forces kind of other market participants to behave in a certain way or to be severely disadvantaged. I wish it were easier. I wish they like had a big sign that they like put up saying we're a monopoly, but you have to look at the behavior, right? You know, if you can require a whole suite of suppliers to forego other business opportunities because losing your business would mean they're unable to operate, right? Or they're operating in at a big disadvantage. That's a real abuse of power. So, you know, I think we see those dynamics all across the economy, just like radiating out from large firms, whether it's Amazon or Ticketmaster or United Health. You know, you can just look across the economy and see these really often similar types of tactics deployed in different industries because of these severe kind of concentrations of power. And those affect consumers negatively, you know, in many cases, or ultimately, whether it's because their privacy is not protected, or because prices are higher, or because all of the local stores in their community are closing, right? So there's things like food deserts or pharmacy deserts that result from concentration in those industries. You know, these are the downstream effects, the markers of market power that we all need to understand, even, you know, particularly businesses. And beyond that, to know that someone is supposed to be policing those types of practices.
Yes.
So we have the Federal Trade Commission, we have the Department of Justice, we have regulatory authority across different federal agencies, HHS, DOT, as we talked about, and then state authorities as well, state enforcers, right? So I think part of the process of kind of awakening to the monopoly power problem in our economy today is also understanding that they are policymaker created problems. Policymakers allowed corporations to flout laws intended and for many years enforced to prevent monopolization. And it's their responsibility now to start enforcing those laws and to correct a lot of the errors of the past. And so if there's one thing I'd want listeners to come away with, it's that someone is responsible for someone who is democratically accountable is responsible for the abuses of market power that we're seeing in our economy today, whether that's a small business who is being disadvantaged because of price discrimination, or a consumer who's being hurt because of price gouging and kind of tacit collusion. Those are problems that policymakers should be held accountable for solving. And I'm heartened that we have some really strong enforcers and some policymakers, both at the federal and state level, who are finally, after, you know, kind of a 40-year slumber, taking that mission incredibly seriously and doing all they can to fight for that.
That's Sarah Millis. Stacey Mitchell, I want to take this to you. We're looking at the Simon & Schuster Penguin Random House merger. The government is not fond of that idea. The New York Times published a piece called The Book Merger That's All About Amazon, and they're talking about how the two want to merge so they can compete with Amazon, which it's really hard to do. And they say if they get big enough, they'll have leverage to stock books on the prices and terms the publisher prefers. And that's basically, if I'm hearing this right, is fighting a monopoly with another monopoly. It sounds like both a feature and a bug, Stacey.
Yeah, it's a bad way to fight monopoly. And when you look more closely into that case and you look at what the documentation that the government has uncovered from the publishers, what you see is that these publishing companies, you know, maybe they're talking about how they're going to be able to counter Amazon in public, but what they're really saying in private is we are going to actually get even closer to Amazon. And, you know, that through this merger, we are going to even wed our business even more to Amazon and orient even more around Amazon. So this is a very, bad deal for the entire book industry, for authors and for readers, booksellers. And it's really important that the government is, you know, stepping in to block this merger. Mm-hmm. It also, I think, you know, as we think about this problem, it's not only, you know, do we need to be saying no to these mergers in the publishing industry and thinking about how do we get a more diverse publishing sector, but it is also really pointing to the problem of needing to tackle Amazon's monopoly power. I mean, this is a company that now is the gatekeeper to commerce. I mean, more and more of our exchange of goods and services is happening online, and Amazon utterly dominates that space. Mm-hmm. And if you're a company that makes or sells anything, books, toys, clothing, you now have to go through Amazon. And that gives Amazon an extraordinary power to rip off your best ideas, to charge exorbitant fees, to decide which products will see the light of day, as in show up in the search results, and which products will not see the light of day. I mean, this is just, you know, this is a company that whose power is so fundamentally at odds with all of our values in terms of liberty and equality and fairness, mm-hmm. that we really need to tackle this directly. So in addition to the lawsuit to stop the publisher merger, you know, I'm really hoping that we'll see a lawsuit from the federal government to require Amazon to spin off its businesses and to really check its power.
Mm-hmm. We've got about 3 minutes left, and I do want to talk about, we're going to fix this in 3 minutes. No, we're not, but I do want to at least get some ideas. Sarah, probably one of the biggest breakups of a monopoly was Ma Bell, breaking up Bell Telephone into smaller companies so it no longer dominated. Is there any lesson for us there as to how to tackle today's monopolies?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, just one thing to kind of start out with is there's no like one solution. There's no one piece of legislation, right? This is really fundamentally kind of changing the way we think about governing. So absolutely, we need to see lawsuits, some of which have already been filed, for example, against Google and Facebook, that call to break up both of those companies as a remedy proceed. We need to see a revision of the way that merger policy is enforced. So if you think about, you know, how do corporations become so big and powerful in the first place? The answer is usually through mergers. It's really a driver, in my mind, of a huge amount of inequality in this country, the ability to kind of concentrate power through mergers and acquisitions. So the federal enforcers are in the process of revising how courts, which have a big role to play, it's maybe another episode in all of this, make decisions around merger policy. So that's actually a very important kind of part of this that's ongoing and will have reverberations, hopefully, for many years. And then we need kind of Congress and we need states to legislate, to rein in different types of industries. In fact, you know, over the summer, Congress passed and the president signed the Ocean Shipping Act. So, you know, ocean shipping was controlled by a cartel. It had been deregulated under the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. And in one of the first really kind of major pieces of legislation to restructure an industry, Congress on a bipartisan basis passed a very good piece of legislation to re-regulate that industry, which was price gouging astronomically, you know, because of and causing kind of major supply chain problems as a result. So we're seeing policymakers really start to regulate these firms, regulate specific industries, at the same time that antitrust enforcers in the Biden administration are prosecuting a very aggressive agenda. And that's what we need to see continue to happen. We need to just continue that work and I think let it grow. Again, New York has done great, is pursuing aggressive legislative remedies. So there's a lot to keep track of. There's a lot to be excited about.
And you know what? I want to get Stacey in here for this last 45 seconds. Stacey, is there anything you would add to that?
Yeah, I think it's not on us as consumers to solve the monopoly problem. You know, that's not going to work. It's not about changing our buying choices and all of that. I mean, that's all important. Don't get me wrong. But I think, you know, as Sarah said, there's incredible things happening at the federal level and in terms of the policy movement around this. And we need to continue to push and reinforce that direction in terms of what's happening at the federal level. And I will also just say there's a ton that you can do at the local and state level. There are all kinds of policies that cities and states can pursue to tackle, to tackle corporate power. We have a guide on our website. It's right on the homepage of our website, a guide to fighting monopoly power at the local and state level. So I encourage people to check that out.
I thank you both so much. It's good to have you. You've been listening to Stacey Mitchell, co-executive director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and Sarah Miller, founder and executive director of the American Economic Liberties Project. B. Sol produced today's show. David LaTulipe has been on the board. I'm Angie Coiro, sitting in for Rose for the last day, and she'll be back with you on Monday. Thanks so much for listening to Your Call.